Omaha Public Radio presents a lecture program from the Jewish Federation of Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Marjorie Engel, a columnist with Tablet Magazine, and author of Mamala Knows Best, What Jewish Mothers Do to Raise Successful, Creative, Empathetic, Independent Children. She'll talk about her book, which she says blends historical texts, scientific research, humor, and personal anecdotes to create a nuanced portrait of the Jewish mother that smashes tired old sexist stereotypes. This program, co-sponsored by Bethel Synagogue and the Jewish Federation of Omaha PJ Library, and made possible by the Jewish Book Council, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 2, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Jewish Federation of Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Nancy Ripps, widely known as the book maven of the Midwest.
For years, I have been a fan of our guest, forever. I've read her in The Forward, in Glamour, in Sassy, in the New York Times, and now Tablet. And the best lesson I learned from this current book: when your child comes home at the end of the day, instead of saying, "What did you do at school today?" try, "Did you ask any questions at school today?" So, ladies and gentlemen, help me give a warm Omaha welcome to the author of Mamala Knows Best. I can hardly wait till she writes Grandmala Knows Best, the one and only Marjorie Engel.
Hi, how's this? Is this okay? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, you just nailed the story that is the genesis of this book. Because my mother, who is a professor of Jewish education at JTS, had told me, you know, I didn't think I wanted to write a parenting book at all. I ghostwrite books for other people, and I write, you know, I don't have a really great attention span, so I write for the newspaper, and I write for magazines, and that's been good. But my mom told me this story about the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Isidore Isaac Rabi, who, you know, grew up in the shtetl in New York City, Yiddish-speaking parents, you know, poor as dirt, and became, you know, a complete rock star in his profession. And somebody said, you know, how did you get from point A to point B? And he said, my mother made me a scientist. Other people's mothers said, what did you learn in school today? And my mother said, Izzy, did you ask a good question today? And that's what made me a scientist. So that really is the genesis of this book, because I was like, oh, people tell, you know, the Jewish mother is this subject of mockery, and it's this shorthand for somebody who's, you know, neurotic and, you know, pressures her kids incessantly and, you know, only wants, you know, the punchline of the joke about the woman is walking down the street with her two little children, and somebody says, oh, they're so cute, how old are they? And she says, the doctor is three and the lawyer is two. So that's the, you know, that's the stereotype. But in reality, you have somebody who's asking open-ended questions of their kid and trying to figure out what will make your kid be curious and ethical and menschy and, you know, have a good sense of humor and be a little wary of authority, which I think is a real Jewish trait. And all of these traits have served the Jews well over time. And it's interesting, unlike the tiger mom, you know, the Jewish mother has somehow managed to raise kids from around the world, you know, all over the world where we've lived. And our kids have been accomplished in so many different fields, in scientific, arts, you know, all different kinds of culture, comedy. And there must be something we're doing right. So that was sort of, the book was sort of an exploration of sort of life in the diaspora, but also a funny look at ways to raise a good kid in a culture that doesn't always value goodness. So I'm going to read from a chapter about the importance of storytelling, which I think is very, you know, that is a very Jewish thing. So storytelling has literally been life-saving for our people. Author Neil Gaiman has talked about his cousin Helen, who survived the Warsaw Ghetto during World War II. At that point in time, books were illegal, and there was a death sentence for anyone found possessing one, he said in an interview with the UN High Refugee Agency. However, Helen had a Polish translation of Gone with the Wind, and she kept it hidden behind a loose brick in the wall. She would stay up late every night reading so that when the girls came in the next day, she could tell them what had happened in the chapters she'd read the previous night. And just for that hour, those girls got out of the Warsaw Ghetto. He concluded, "This made me realize that fiction isn't just escapism. It can actually be escape, and it's worth dying for." Narratives are how we form identity. Family stories and religious stories, as well as the books we have at home, tell kids who they are, where they're from, and what we hope they'll value. Everything can be an opportunity for a story. Making dinner, events in the news, taking your kids to vote, even buying a toothbrush. Horim and Morim, parents and teachers, come from the same root. Stories teach morality. They invite debate. A huge part of good parenting is encouraging the whys, even though hearing a ton of why can make you want to put your own eye out with a spork. When my daughter Josie was 6, she exploded at Maxie, then 3. Why? I'm sick of you always saying why. In my infinitely patient mother voice, I said, "Josie, all little kids say why all the time. You said why all the time." "I know," Josie replied, "but the difference is I didn't have to listen to it." Jews have always been all about the why. Why did God ask Abraham to sacrifice his only son? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why aren't Jews allowed to eat pork? We're not? Uh-oh. That was a Woody Allen joke. Our oral tradition is vast and lively. In addition to all the arguing, we have lots of prayers to memorize, lots of singing, lots of chanting. Our written tradition didn't really start until after 70 CE, when Jews were scattered to the winds, when we weren't all in each other's faces all the time, and perhaps when Christianity began to pick up steam and Jews started to realize they'd better get their stuff codified before it got snuffed out or mixed in with other people's stories. Linguist Deborah Tannen, in her studies of Jewish conversational patterns, says that Jews tend to tell more stories in conversation, tell them dramatically, and focus on the emotional experience of a story more than other groups. Not only does this hamminess make for engaging, lively storytelling, but it also teaches kids to identify with and question varying points of view. Jewish mothers have always been the storytellers in chief. A Yiddish proverb says, "One mother achieves more than 100 teachers." Whether we're outside work moms or at home most of the time moms, we are usually the ones conveying values, setting expectations of behavior, nurturing the curiosity and love of learning and confidence and general chutzpah that together have allowed Jews to become leaders in an immense number of fields across strata of political thought and throughout arts and sciences. I would argue that the storytelling is a big part of why. Another Yiddish proverb, yes, another one, shut up, says, "The entire world rests on the tip of the tongue." The spoken word has the power to transport, entertain, encourage dreams, crush hopes, elucidate, educate, and enlighten. How stories make us smarter. All kinds of stuff happens in the brain when we hear a story. MRIs have shown that not only do the parts of the brain that work on language processing light up, but all the areas of the brain that we would need if the stories were real are activated too. For instance, if a storyteller talks about the delicious smell of chicken soup simmering on the stove, the listener's olfactory cortex is engaged. If the story involves racing through snowy woods, blood flow increases to the listener's motor cortex, the part of the brain that initiates voluntary muscle activity. Sharing a narrative not only encourages different parts of the brain, not only engages different parts of the brain, but also builds connections between the tale-teller and the listener. Uri Hasson of Princeton's Neuroscience Institute has shown that during a storytelling session, the speaker and the listeners experience very similar brain activity. Princeton calls it a mind meld, which I will allow, because Spock is a cool geek. The notion that stories have brain-boosting power is echoed by Raymond Marr, a psychologist at York University in Canada. He analyzed 86 MRI studies and found that stories help us understand other people better. When we identify with characters' struggles and triumphs and adventures and desires, we gain insight into actual human behavior. Marr also found that there's a lot of overlap in the areas of the brain that interpret stories and the areas that assist us in interactions with other people. So stories increase kids' social savvy and empathy. Be a storyteller and build a storyteller and help human beings connect. Read to your kids for as long as they will let you.
Jews as a group have been literate perhaps as far back as the 10th century BCE. Our stories were some of the things we could carry with us as we got kicked out of Carthage, Alexandria, the Visigoth Empire, Mainz, France, Germany, Upper Bavaria, England, Switzerland, Saxony, Hungary, Belgium, Slovakia, Italy, Spain, Sicily, Lithuania, Portugal, Pia, Austria, Ukraine, and Poland. Some of those countries led us back and then booted us again, much like Lucy yanking the football away from Charlie Brown, only with more death. I don't necessarily think Jews are smarter than other groups. Maybe we just read more. If I actually believed Jews were inherently brainier than other people due to our awesome Jewy genes, I would not be writing a book telling you that Jewish parenting is worth emulating. Also, I would be insufferable. Research shows that hearing stories aloud builds language skills that make learning to read on one's own easier and more pleasurable. Hearing a book over and over, while deeply annoying for the parent who has to read that book, helps kids gain comprehension, reinforces neural connections, and assists with memory, vocabulary, and sequencing. Being read to leads to greater interest in books, and greater interest in books leads to more school success and more creative thinking. You have all my sympathy if you are reading Barnyard Dance for the 7 zillionth time, but welcome to parenthood. We've all been there. Suck it up. Repetition is a vital developmental stage, even if it makes you want to climb down that ladder that the love you forever mom left at her son's window, that freak, and flee into the night. Read to kids, not because reading is a tool to winning the race to the top or conquering the common core, but because it's fun, because school is not enough, because books give kids the sense of the bigness of the universe and all the possibilities their future holds. The world changes so fast now. Learning things isn't enough. To be able to think on their feet, as Jews have done throughout history, you have to learn how to think. You have to want to challenge yourself and want to explore. George Saunders, a writer I adore, once said, "A minute spent reading to your kids now will repay itself a millionfold later, not only because they love you for reading to them, but also because years later, when they're miles away, those quiet evenings when you were tucked in with them, everything quiet but the sound of the page turns will seem to you, I promise, sacred." I have read that sentence 100 times, and it still makes me weepy. Today, when test score-obsessed schools are teaching texts instead of books, teaching semi-coherent snippets instead of sustained stories, it's even more important to encourage older kids to explore stories and books. Professor Marr has done work showing that readers of fiction tend to be more empathetic and better at making inferences than those who aren't big fans. But whatever your kid will read, online news, magazines, fan fiction, graphic novels, terrible emo poetry, is worth reading. From around age 4 on, my daughter Josie disliked books with non-human protagonists, except Wilbur from Charlotte's Web. And thank goodness, because if you don't love Wilbur, I don't want to know you. Maxie rejected all books with pretty pastel art. She preferred bolder, cartoonier illustrations. If a book isn't working for your kids, for God's sake, give up and try something else. Help kids find their literary sweet spot. Maxie took her sweet time reading independently. She just wasn't interested, but she always loved stories. So I kept reading to her and tried hard, sometimes successfully, not to stress about her unhurriedness to strike out on her own. Much later, my mom pointed out that my younger daughter is an oral learner, not a visual one. I was worried about her learning the Ashrei, the long and wordy Hebrew prayer, in time to recite it at Josie's bat mitzvah. I tried teaching it to her in Hebrew. I tried transliterating. And just when I was ready to back off and suggest she do an easier prayer, my mom suggested singing the Ashrei to Max and having her sing it back, phrase by phrase, rather than trying to help her sound out each syllable. And you know what? She learned it perfectly in a matter of days. Someone in the synagogue who didn't know our family asked if that little girl reading the prayer was Israeli. The moral of this story, we all learn differently. Maxie is a listener. Listening to stories is a good way for listeners to learn. For Maxie, the thing that triggered reading for fun was graphic novels. I think a huge unbroken block of text daunted her, but her eyes liked darting around the lively, busy pages of Zita the Space Girl. She still loves graphic novels, but now she also reads novels. Graphic novels were what opened a door. She also loved her Rebecca Rubin American Girl doll, which turned out to be an awesome Trojan horse for literacy. I loathe the consumerist terror that is the American Girl store, where Kit's bed costs as much as an actual child-sized bed at IKEA, and the entire chirpy experience is like roaming a terrifying zombie hellscape. But it turns out that Rebecca and her fellow insanely expensive hunks of plastic have a zillion books associated with them, and a lot of those books are good. One of the Rebecca books is set against the backdrop of the labor strikes of the 1910s and discusses the role of Jewish labor leader Clara Lemlich. Though Brave Girl, a picture book about Clara Lemlich by Michelle Markell, illustrated by Melissa Sweet, I just put a plug in there, and I think it's available through PJ Library, is even better. After reading Rebecca's books, Maxie wanted to read all the other books about all the other historical girls, even though she didn't have the dolls. And TV can be your encouragement reading buddy, too. Are you aware that there are a zillion Adventure Time and My Little Pony books? If your spawn is a sports freak and some athlete they love has written a children's book, which probably sucks, but who cares, check your own taste at the door and pick it up at the library. For a couple of years, Maxie was insane about Wildcrats. Do you know that show? Yeah. A TV show about two dude bros with annoying vocal mannerisms that teach us all about wildlife. Whenever she started monologuing about wild turkey roosting patterns and spider web construction, I knew to blame the Kratts. So for the duration of her obsession, I got her photography books by Nick Bishop, featuring super freaky close-ups of spiders and snakes. And we went to the zoo, and we made up stories about penguins, and I let her stop and pet every damn dog on the street and chat with the owners if the owners were willing. And if I were a really great mother, I would have arranged for her to volunteer at an animal shelter. But I am merely a good enough mother, see chapter 2, and I am tired. Also, model the behavior you want to see. Be sure your kids see your love of storytelling, narrative-oriented stand-up comedy, reading for pleasure rather than out of some noble obligation to better yourself. I'm not going to read this one out loud. You can get the book if you want to read this. Debate ideas at the table. Ask your kid lots of questions about what they're reading and listen to the answers. And be sneaky. Judy Blume suggests if we want our kids to read, simply leave books lying around the house and periodically say nonchalantly, "Oh, you're not ready to read this yet." I love her. Talk about what you're reading and why you love it or why you're frustrated by it. Your kid will feel important that you want to talk about literature with him, and you give him the opportunity to build vocabulary and comprehension. Finally, storytelling is a damn good excuse for cuddling. Not everything has to be about success later in life. There are joys in the here and now, too. Reading, storytelling, making up silly poems together. It's all good. I could read the little methodology thing if you want. Yeah, so think of questions while I'm just reading. So every chapter ends in a sort of a series of suggestions about what you can do at home. So Mamala methodology. 1, storytelling does not just mean reading. Listen to podcasts and radio shows like The Moth, play audiobooks in the car, retell folktales, fairy tales, urban legends, family stories. Whenever you're telling or reading a story, keep your kid engaged by asking them open-ended questions about the characters or plot, questions that the kid can't answer with a yes or a no. 2, if your kid doesn't like to read, don't give up. You just haven't found the right book. Explore different kinds of fiction, poetry, graphic novels, books of world records, kooky facts, profiles of presidents and sports heroes, gross-out science books. Get suggestions from a cool teacher or librarian. If your kid has a learning disability or just isn't into reading on their own, read aloud to them, tell stories, and listen to audiobooks together for as long as your kid will let you. 3, you can't go wrong with funny. For younger kids, rhyming books are great. They can guess at each rhyme, so there's built-in suspense. Have no shame when you read out loud. Do accents, take dramatic pauses, modulate your voice, raising and lowering it to build narrative momentum. Let your children mock you. My kids always loved when I cried at the end of Charlotte's Web or Mrs. Katz and Tush. They'd look at each other, snickering, clearly thinking, "Poor mom, she's daft." 4, dedicate your time to reading. Make it a ritual. Make it part of your day. If your kid is not a sit-still kid, even 15 minutes of reading a day is good. And again, you might just not be reading the right book. 5, let kids choose their own books. I have never told my kids they were not allowed to read something. I learned this from my fabulous mom, who watched me read Debbie Putnoy's copy of Judy Blume's Forever at a house party when I was 9. Adults were giving her an earful about letting me read something so risque, But she kept replying with variants of, if she has questions, she'll ask me. That was a big lesson for me. And now that I'm a parent, I've exercised veto power only at bedtime and only once or twice. Because when young Josie got scared, she became a hysterical hilaria and would fight sleep for days and make us all want to die of exhaustion. Advice within advice. Let your children read Roald Dahl's The Witches only during daylight hours. And if your kid is reading books you don't approve of, from sexist comic books to poorly written sparkly vampire romance, the worst thing you can do is ban what they love. Talk about why you think certain books are dumb or offensive, or better yet, let your kid make a book recommendation, actually read the thing that they suggest, and then discuss the book together. Don't shame your kid for having different tastes from yours. 6, harness peer pressure. Kids take book recommendations from other kids more seriously than they do recommendations from adults. When Josie went through a sci-fi and fantasy stage, a genre about which I am clueless, she got book suggestions from her friend Nora. 7, get your kid into series books. They may not be the greatest literature, but they create anticipation and identification with recurring characters. You can always mindlessly borrow or buy the next one in the series, which is a huge relief when you would rather be thinking about a cocktail than kidlit. 8, kids see through, do as I say, not as I do. Model the behavior you want to see. Invite your kid to sit next to you on the couch as you both read. Keep books out in baskets, on shelves, on coffee tables. The way I got Josie to read Harry Potter, which I knew she would love, but which she stubbornly refused to try because she is contrary like her mother, was to take it on vacation, leave it on the coffee table of our rental house, and say absolutely nothing. 9, pro tip. True truths and a lie is a good way to get sullen tweens to tell a story. You know this game. At dinner, everyone has to say 3 things that happened that day, 2 of which are true and 1 of which isn't. Then everyone else has to guess which one's the lie. It is a sneaky way to get anecdotes out of your kids beyond, how was your day? Fine. So. I like when people talk to each other. So, you know, we've had some of these before where people talk about, you know, reading strategies with other people, or people talk about sort of the kind of family stories that have resonated with their kids. Like, I think kids always like to hear, you know, your story about being a horrible, horrible child. So, you know, any story anybody else wants to tell is good too.
So I'd love, I mean, you also write for Tablet, and you've done columns in newspapers, all sorts of, all across the board. I'm curious, in visualizing this book that you've now put out, how did you take from all the different pieces of your career path, and are you excited about how it ended up?
Good question. We talked at lunch about in one of the episodes of Tablet's podcast, everybody was making fun of me because this book was a year late, and I don't miss deadlines when I'm writing newspaper and magazine stories, and I really screwed up. And I had so much trouble figuring out what kind of voice to use because, you know, when I write for the New York Times, I have a sort of New York Times voice. And when I write for Tablet, I have a much sort of snarkier, more informal voice. And I ghostwrite, so then I try to write in somebody else's voice. So I just wasn't sure what, you know, how to write a book that was my book. You know, figuring out what the chapters were going to be and what the attributes I thought were important for Jewish parents to convey to kids helped, like having the structure really helped. And I wrote the first draft and gave it to my mom, you know, who's a professor, and she read it. She's like, this is wonderful. And then I gave it to my best friend, who's a novelist, who was like, this sucks. And she said, you know, there is a lot of research in this book, but it's hopefully kind of hidden and couched in, you know, a friendly, accessible way. And in the beginning, I felt very defensive about making sure that people knew I had done work. And I quoted other people all the time, and it was boring. And my friend was like, you know, I know you don't, and I'm always like, I'm a journalist, so I'm not an authority. I listen to other people, and I read about what, you know, and I research, but I don't know anything. And she was like, you can be self-deprecating, but you have to own your authority as a writer. So I redid the whole thing and made it much more, you know, casual. And I think it works better that way. She was right. And my mom was like, I like the first one better.
Okay, so my question pertains to the high school kids. So, from personal experience, my son is reading like Romeo and Juliet and Oedipus Rex and the Odyssey, and he's not so much loving that. So my question for you is, okay, so when these kids are reading books that they don't love as much as what they would rather be reading, you know, after they do that, they're kind of done. So is there a strategy that you would have to help kids maybe get more into, or, you know, maybe they go into the book thinking, oh, the Odyssey is really long, I'm going to hate it. You know, I don't know if that's kind of what they're thinking, but it can be kind of daunting, some of these books that they read in high school. Do you have a strategy for helping them enjoy that more? Because I think that does deter them from wanting to do further reading.
Totally.
So I, you know, one of the things, I like that question because it's about school, and I definitely distinguish throughout the book between what they have to do in school and what you're doing at home. Like, a part of me wants to die when people are like, you know, I want my kid to only be reading, you know, I hear from a lot of parents of little kids saying she's ready for chapter books, but she just wants to read picture books. And it's like, let her read picture books. You know, let school worry about what level. And if she wants to just reread the same thing over and over, you know, I'm telling you this, but it doesn't, you know, in my own head, I'm like, oh my God, Maxine is reading The School for Good and Evil for the 400th time. But so for schoolwork, I think it is a valuable lesson that sometimes you just have to suck it up. But, you know, for something like The Odyssey, there are graphic novel versions. I would think, as a funny joke, there's actually a board book version, which I think is hilarious that somebody made a board book of The Odyssey. And you could show that to your kid and be like, somebody seen it? You know, there are movies. You know, you don't want it to replace the reading that the kid has to do for school. But I also think you can share stories about the reading that you were forced to do in high school that you hated. You know, like we had to read, I don't know why everybody makes kids in high school read The Great Gatsby, which is such, it's short, but it is such a grown-up book about such grown-up concerns. You know, when people who aren't even thinking about mortality yet are like supposed to be reading this book and understanding it. I actually think Romeo and Juliet, when a smart teacher will make a kid read it out, they'll make them read it out loud in class, because when you read it out loud, you do understand it better, and that might be a strategy for reading at home, is tell him to read out loud to himself. And, you know, the Baz Luhrmann version is, the movie version, is so smoking hot that, you know, he might like that. All you can do is be supportive and commiserate, because a lot of times schools do not. You know, I like when schools pick books that are actually enticing to kids, because it seems like that is such an important value, and that there are books like that that fulfill Common Core requirements but are also, you know, going to nurture a love of reading.
So I really like the chapter here about the reading. I want to get your input on children writing, especially as a journalist.
I was at a party. I guess it was a New Year's party, and there was a 11-year-old girl there, and she was wearing a button for NaNoWriMo. Do you know what that is? It's National Novel Writing Month, and it's this thing that a lot of people share stories about on the internet, about just trying, you know, low pressure, low bar, write a novel in November. And she was wearing the button, and I was like, oh, you know about that? And she's like, yeah, I wrote a novel. And I'm like, rock on! And, you know, this violent, you know, scary, you know, fantasy thing, and awesome. I think also about, you know, I kind of made it a joke, but it kind of wasn't, that Josie was so easily scared by books, but really wanted to keep reading. And it was really traumatic for the whole family when she would go through periods when she was 4 and 6 and 8 of really being afraid to sleep. And then part of me was like, we did family therapy, and part of me was like, she's manipulating us. And then she brought home work probably when she was 7 from school, where she wrote and illustrated her dreams. And they were so scary for me to even look at that it, like there was this one of just, it was like this monk thing of all of these faces squeezed into the page, all screaming. And it was all, it was so scary that I was like more sympathetic to her from her own, you know, her, and her writing did that. And she still is this, you know, tightly wound and sensitive kid, but she's, you know, that period ended, which is good. So I think we should all encourage kids to write. Sometimes if your kid is not this kind of writer, like you, you can play rhyming, you know, writing poems in the car as you drive. One person says something, the next person makes a rhyme. You know, if your kid is not interested in writing, I think drawing is just as good. You know, you can tell a story that way. There's this great comic book in a box thing where it comes and it teaches you how to make panels, and you can do that on the computer too and write graphic novels yourself. That's, you know, I definitely feel like I had, for my second kid, my eyes got opened to the value of that kind of storytelling. And yeah, poems, encourage your kid to write poems. Yeah, I remember when Josie was born, one of my friends gave me this book of like horrible teen emo poetry and said, and wrote, "This is your future" inside it. And it actually was. So, was there something more specific you were asking about?
I wrote it for my own sake, and I know that was the way my parents pushed me to write. It was not to write anything that they would read, but just something to write for my own sake.
That's great. He said that he kept a journal, and his parents encouraged that just for his own sake, which I think is lovely. I also think, you know, the rules have really changed with the internet, and you know, I feel like, A, we panic a lot about kids not reading because they're always on the computer. But, you know, I've learned from Josie, you know, she's telling me she's reading Cosmopolitan on Snapchat. But they're, if you're paying attention, they are doing all this hardcore political reporting now that's only on the online, that's not reflected in the magazine at all, but it's this whole other staff and this whole other world. And they have, you know, Jill Filipovic, who's like a big political journalist, writing for them. And, you know, they use, I mean, I guess these younger smart media companies are using the apps that the kids use to get them to read. And she, you know, she's, you know, she gets politics from BuzzFeed, which is annoying and terrifying, but they also sometimes have good stuff in there. And but she doesn't want to read books online. And, you know, I love reading on my iPad, and she hates it. And I think a lot of that is also because I think kids, all kids, like to share the experience of books and like give, you know, "I loved this," and give it to their friend. And I think that's lovely, and it's harder to do when it's a digital thing. But I think they also, because they're talking to each other constantly in text messages, and, you know, my kids go to a school that's called the Institute for Collaborative Education, so everything is super collaborative. And I watch the way they work together in a Google Doc, and they're, you know, editing so fast and then chatting in the margins about nothing, about things that aren't related to the assignment, and it's happening so fast, and like, you know, I thought I was young like 10 years ago. I just realized there's this whole other way of communicating that I don't know about. So I do think kids are reading and writing a lot, you know, more than we think. And sometimes we sort of do this hand waving, you know, Homer also had the hand waving panic back in, you know, the days of the Odyssey about, you know, the kids today. So I'm not wildly worried. And I also think that journalism is in, you know, if you had asked me 2 years ago, I would have told you that I thought journalism was doomed. And I think, you know, now in a politically challenging time, people are really seeing the value of reporting. So now I'm not necessarily convinced that journalism is doomed. So,
as a journalist who writes short,
yes,
can you speak a little about the process that how you switch to writing long, coming to a book?
Yes. So I'm used to writing other people's books, and there's no, I don't feel, you know, I want to do a good job, but I don't feel any pressure, and, you know, I can let the way that the theoretical author of the book, I can let their storytelling sort of dictate it. But for this, I was just, you know, it just seems like this big unbroken thing, and I've never written fiction, so I don't know about the process of writing a novel. And again, with the friend who is a novelist, the fact that she starts a book and doesn't know how it's going to end just completely freaks me out. So with this, it was just like, okay, figure out what the attributes are that I think are important in Jewish parenting. You know, look at all of my source material and write down, you know, proverbs and anecdotes and bits of history and bits of, you know, Tachinas, which are old, you know, Jewish women's prayer books, and just anything I found interesting, just put it down. And then once I knew what the chapters were going to be, I could sort of dole out where anecdotes would go. And I didn't want to say anything. You know, I wrote a piece in Tablet a few years ago about I don't write about my kids. I write almost nothing about them now because they're old enough to have an expectation of privacy. And when you're writing about, you know, I've been writing, you know, I started at the Forward. The first piece I wrote for the Forward was about Josie's baby naming ceremony, and she's 15 now. So, but when they were, I don't know, like 10 and 7, I wrote a piece about, like, don't get used to this. You know, I'm done now. And mostly I write about if I write about parenting stuff, I write about it in theory and not about my own kids. And they get to read anything I write if it says their name in it. So they, you know, they got to vet this. So it was just about figuring out how personal I wanted to be and what personal stories I would tell. And I didn't want to write a memoir. So just sort of figuring out how to make it flow. And also, you know, I wanted to write a history book, but people don't give you money to write history books. They give you money to write parenting books, and I have a mortgage. So I feel like it's a history book. And I also wanted to write something because people are always telling women and mothers that they're doing it wrong, whatever they're doing. Like, I just think about the whole dichotomy of, you know, the helicopter parent and the free-range parent, and you can write a mocking narrative about either one of them, and it's like, we can't win. So I wanted to write a book that was sort of reassuring that, like, you know, I say in the book, you really only have to listen to Dr. Spock, who said, listen to yourself, you know more than you think you do. And I just wanted to tell women, no matter what you're doing, you know, you have a culture that's telling you you're screwing up, and you're probably not, and kids are resilient, and just do your best, and be a good enough mother, and that's good enough. And there's actually research about being a good enough mother is a lot better for your kid than being a perfect mother. But you could read that in the book. So does that sort of answer? Just break it up into chunks. Like, that's the Anne Lamott, who is, you know, she wrote this great Bird by Bird. If you have any interest in writing, it's just such a good book about the process of writing. And the title comes from her little brother leaving a report until the last possible minute. And it was supposed to be about the birds of the United States. And he was just like, and the dad was like, just take it bird by bird. And that's how you write a book, is just bird by bird.
Question. Thank you so much for coming tonight. I really
yeah,
enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me. Said. I like
yeah.
Omaha.
Yeah. Is this your first time here?
Yes.
Really? Awesome. Yeah. Well, one of the reasons I was excited about you coming here is because I think one of the groups of people that isn't represented as much in writing in general is women with children. And I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old right now and trying to write a dissertation. And I was just wondering what your experience has been with writing and with children, and do you write at home with them, or do they have to be out of the house, and do you write in big chunks or little chunks, or how do you do it?
I had the fantasy that I think a lot of people have when I had my first kid, that you know, Josie would nap in a Moses basket by my feet. That didn't happen. So I made sure that my caregiver got a shout out in here. We had a great babysitter when the kids were little. I'm very, very fortunate that, you know, I could manage to cobble together a living from a lot of different jobs and work at home a lot of the time. I mean, I'm still only in the Tablet office 2 days a week. You know, now I'm touring more, but the kids are older, so it's okay. I think you have to be really gentle with yourself, and if it takes you longer than you think, I mean, 3-in-1 is really hard. And, you know, can you, you know, have childcare and, you know, try to be disciplined. You know, for me, I have to use the program that lets you not get onto Facebook, you know, that locks you out. You know, you have to be efficient with your time and be forgiving of yourself when it's harder than you think and you're allowed to cry sometimes. I'm sorry. I wish I had a better answer.
That is great. Thank you.
Go you.
Hi, thanks very much. You earlier in your remarks alluded to the differences between the Jewish mother parenting model and the tiger mom. Could you elaborate a little bit and maybe discuss what they have in common, how they're different, what your research shows, and particularly from your perspective, what the outcome, you know, what kind of adults are those two models likely to produce?
Well, there's a new book out called Jew-Asian, and I'm very curious to read it. The book, The Tiger Mom, the Revenge of the Tiger Mother thing, whatever it's called, Ballad of the, what was it called? I forget the exact title. But I actually read it, and it is not the thing that it is purported to be. It's a memoir, and it's this very self-deprecating thing about her philosophy. She's being deliberately inflammatory, and she talks about not letting her kids have play dates and forcing them. They could only choose the violin or the piano. They could never be in a school play. She had all of these rules. And for her older kid, and it worked great, and her kid actually did a concert at Carnegie Hall, the younger kid was going to kill her or kill herself. And the husband, the Jewish husband, was finally like, you gotta let up. Like, you can't make her into you. And she learned that her parenting methods actually didn't work for two children. I always say, like, also, just never take parenting advice from anyone with one child, because once you learn how it works, then you have another kid and nothing works for that kid. So, you know, only take advice from somebody with more than one. But, you know, certainly the tiger mom stereotype is this incredibly rigid, demanding, no praise thing. The part that I think might be kind of true is a big difference between the Jewish parent historically. I feel like right now we're in this weird place where, you know, on the one hand you have this huge rise in anti-Semitic hate crimes, and on the other hand we're so insider, but we're not. So historically the Jewish mother was the questions thing, and we've been suspicious of authority, and for very good reason. And the tiger mom thing is, the classroom is a fiefdom. You perform for your teacher. You do what you have to do. You do well in school. And a lot of times, being a creative, paradigm-breaking, innovative writer or scientist or actor means not pleasing authority figures, because you're creating something new. And, you know, look, science is about replicating results, and that means that you're going to prove other people wrong. The reason why acting is so interesting is you see, you know, a million different ways to do Hamlet. You don't want somebody who's just going to watch a video of Laurence Olivier and do it just like that. And I think historically Jews have been very good. You know, there's a lot of stuff about Glückel of Hamelin, who is a late 17th and 18th century diarist, and you read the diaries, and there's so many concerns that are like our concerns now about making sure your kids are happy and healthy and have work that fulfills them. And, you know, she had like 17 children or something. It was 12, but she felt like 17. And, you know, trying to figure out what her kids were good at just makes me think of Jewish mothers all the time. It's like, what do you like? What do you love? How can I help you do that thing? And not pushing them into that thing, but just, you know, encouraging who your kid actually is and trying to direct it in a good way and trying to make them, you know, I worry so much now about the pressure kids are under in terms of standardized tests and getting into, you know, the five colleges that are acceptable. And it's not good for education. It's not good for kids. And we want to, you know, we're always shocked when, you know, these cheating scandals roil private, fancy private schools, you know, the very prestigious New York City public schools, Ramaz, every once in a while there's this huge scandal. And it's like, because we've told them that they're nothing more than a test score. And you can, you know, talk about values all you want, but when they can tell that that's secondary, there's a lot of research in here about a project that comes out of the Harvard School of Education where they talk to kids about what their parents value and, you know, what their ethics are. And it's disturbing because they do feel like everything else is second to being number one. and we got to watch that.
So what's your thought on public libraries? Archaic or undervalued?
Undervalued.
Yeah. The question was, what do I think of public libraries, archaic or undervalued? And I was always one of those people who was super snotty about, you know, when I moved to New York, when I was in my early 20s, and there would be these, you know, library lions benefits, and they would be in the society pages of all these beautifully fancy dressed people, you know, going to benefits for the library. And I was like, there are people starving, there are, you know, people dying, and you're just putting on a fancy dress and going to the library. And now I appreciate just the number of things that libraries do that sort of we comfortable, you know, upper middle class Jews don't see, in terms of job training, in terms of literacy, in terms of computer skills, in terms of, you know, English as a second language, you know, childcare, you know, a place to go when it's cold. You know, I also think about, now that I'm friends with a lot, you know, this is a nice thing about Facebook, because I have a lot, I review a lot of children's books for the Times, and so now I'm friends with all of these children's librarians. And just knowing how much of a safe space the library is for kids who do not have a safe space at home is huge. And if you have a parent who doesn't, you know, a family situation that's bad, or, you know, the library is a lifesaver, in addition to, you know, being a place where a great librarian can make a kid loved books. And books, you know, every study from countries around the world, there's this PISA study that looks at education across countries. If a kid reads, the impact is huge. And it has much more of an, and once you've corrected for income and parental education and race, reading, reading, reading. And I think a library is everything for that. So I'm no longer snotty about the rich people raising money for the library. Go for it, rich people. Thank you all so much.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Jewish Federation of Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Marjorie Engel, a columnist with Tablet Magazine, and author of Mamala Knows Best, What Jewish Mothers Do to Raise Successful, Creative, Empathetic, Independent Children. She talked about her book, which she says blends historical texts, scientific research, humor, and personal anecdotes to create a nuanced portrait of the Jewish mother that smashes tired old sexist stereotypes. This program, co-sponsored by Bethel Synagogue and the Jewish Federation of Omaha PJ Library, and made possible by the Jewish Book Council, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 2nd, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jenny Gates Beckman, Director of Community Engagement and Education with the Jewish Federation of Omaha, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next lecture in the Jewish Federation of Omaha author series will be this Wednesday, March 29th at 7 p.m. at the Jewish Community Center Social Hall. The speaker will be Jason Gewurz, an executive producer with CNBC, and author of Israel's Edge, the story of the IDF's most elite unit, Talpiot. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.